So we learned a very important thing in this week's episode.
And what was that? That roots take 3 hours to make?
Well, that, and also that Nog's lobes were tingling, which I really did not want to know.
Well, especially because, I mean, he's 13, right? So that's the age
I think
when,
so.
I mean, he's supposed to be he's roughly Jake's age. So yeah, he's an early teenager. And I remember in my early teenager, the equivalent of my lobes tingled pretty much all the time. It was a very confusing period for me.
Fun fact about the actor who plays Nog and the actor who plays Jake.
They're the same person.
No, the actor who plays, that's a good guess, is actually quite a bit older. He's an adult, and you know, the guy who plays Jake was actually like a kid, like a teenager.
Yeah.
And they got along really well because the first time that the actor who plays Jake saw the actor who plays Nog, and I don't know their names. I'm sorry I keep saying that. he was in makeup and didn't realize that Nog was actually like an adult.
Oh.
So he thought he was the same age.
Aw. Yeah.
So part of this episode is really good, and part of this episode is not very good.
Okay.
I will leave it to Richard's imagination to explain which one is which.
You know, this episode was pretty much a cross between the Native American Indian episode and the episode where Ro joins the terrorists at the end.
An interesting comparison.
Well, I mean, because it is somebody who's being forced off their land for some kind of reasons that have nothing to do with their direct, and they don't, you know, want to leave. They have a connection to it. And then she's also, you know, the relationship that she has with this guy reminds me of Ro's relationship with the terrorist leader. It's not quite as charged a relationship, considering that he just is a stubborn old man in this episode. But, you know, they do have a very, you know, grandfatherly almost relationship. They're both kind of colorful old men, you know, and all of that. You know,
aside from the sex scene.
Well, you know, was there a sex scene?
Did you actually watch this episode?
I mean, yeah, but sometimes I forget things.
No, there was not a sex scene.
Okay. In terms of someone being forced off their land plot, I thought this was much more effective. Because, I mean, the one with the Indians was obviously had some problematic elements. It had some elements which didn't quite work here, since it was a much more personal story. The stakes made a little more sense, were a little clearer. Didn't have as many implications as the original one did. And I just happen to find this incarnation of it better done. That said, in terms of a character being attempted to join a very different lifestyle, I like the Ro episode a lot better because, I don't know, I guess that plot did have more stakes than this one did.
I kind of get where you're going with that, and I think it's an interesting comparison, but I think that it only works part way because I think the progress is, it's a different episode with different aims, in that the Ro episode, Preemptive Strike, was really about Ro coming to terms with the fact that she did not want to be in Starfleet and that she had sort of a higher moral responsibility to fight for the Bajoran people or whatever, right? I didn't like Preemptive Strike, so that's kind of, I'm being a little bit dismissive of it, but yeah, I get what you're saying. Whereas in Progress, this is much more of an episode that is very ambiguous about the whole idea. And it's, you know, the Preemptive Strike was TNG going, I think, about as dark as it could go. And Progress is not a dark episode, but it's a very, very, I think it's almost a cynical episode, because it's the Bajorans who are displacing the Bajorans.
It's about Kira becoming the man, basically.
Well, yeah. Well, and that's really the thing, and I think that's something that you know, if you talk about Kira's arc in this season so far, in as much as any character has had an arc, you know, and we talked about battle lines from a week or two ago, one of the things that was most striking about that episode was the scene with Kaio Paak and Kira, how they were talking about her coming to terms with her anger. And I think that what Kira's arc has been in this season is someone who is coming to terms with the fact that she is in a very different position professionally than she was a year ago. She's won her war, and now she needs to come to terms with the fact that she is part of the establishment. And she's this is the episode where she kind of, I don't know that she accepts it, but I think that she realizes that this is...
She doesn't really have a choice in a lot of ways. To borrow an old phrase,
I think that the needs of the many are outweighing the needs of the few here, and I think that's what she's realizing.
Well, yeah, she's had to come... Again, in the episode, the early episode where she meets the terrorist friend of hers, and she's saying, you know, the Federation is, you know, we have to find, you know, Bajor's new hope is the wormhole and all of that. You know, she knows intellectually that this, you know, this is the way that things have to go. But Kaya Paco was kind of the first, yet was that first half of that realization. Again, you have all this anger and you have to let go of it. And this episode is kind of is the other half of that. You have to let go of it because now you're in charge. You're not fighting, you know. She's seeing this. Here's somebody fighting for his land, and she sees a very noble cause, and she immediately wants to fight for it. And the point of her in this episode is, well, that's not you anymore. You know, this is not a fight. Number one, this may not really be a fight worth having. You know, he is holding back, you know, as they said, you know, this is going to heat the entirety of Bajor for the winter. And, you know, we knew that one of the big problems with Bajor was that it had no resources. Here is the Federation kind of coming up with one of its first dividends. It's helped to figure out how to power the planet. You know, but Kira has to enforce this because this is kind of her putting her money where her mouth is. If the Federation really is going to help Bajor go into its next era, this is a concrete example of it doing it, and she has to make the tough decisions and she has to enforce the tough things. It's not, I think Sisko at one point says you don't have to like it, you know, it isn't simple, and she's
realizing that. she's got a job to do, and there are certain things that everybody has to do in their job that they don't particularly like or agree with. And I think that, you know, aside from that aspect of the episode, I think that one of the parts of the episode that is most striking is the character of Mullabok, because of course he is, you know, he's a grumpy old man to a certain degree.
We love him. I loved him instantly. He's a very,
he's very
charismatic. He's fun to watch in this.
Well, and I think one of the interesting things about this is that, you know, in the trivia for this episode, the writer, the initial, or, you know, the guy who came up with the idea, said that he wanted Mullabok to be less likable. And I think that shows a fundamental misunderstanding of his own episode, because I think that this episode would not have worked if we didn't like Mullabok. I think that we need to like him. He needs to be a cantankerous old man who has some sort of hidden past. You know, he's telling these elaborate stories. I mean, are they true? Are they not true? I mean, you know, it to a certain degree, it doesn't really matter.
That one scene when they're at dinner, I mean, he's telling a fish story, basically. And,
yeah,
you know, again, I find that this show is a lot more this show's a lot better at comedy than TNG was, but Kira's doing some amazing.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah. She's doing some really good straight man work in that scene when, you know, he's talking about, you know, I plowed that earth. I killed six of the Cardassians. You know, I was glad there were only six as I was wounded. You know, I thought that was a very funny scene. I liked it.
Well, I think that's a really important scene for Kira, because that shows that Kira has a fundamental respect for the elderly, and she understands that this man has constructed a narrative around his life that is very important to him. And I think that what she's trying to do in the first half of the episode before she kind of goes over to his side is, you know, respect him enough and get his trust so that he is going to trust her when she says that he has to leave. And of course, I don't think that Kira understands his devotion to his home, and Kira is ultimately the one who gets sucked into that.
You know, I think it's interesting how for most of the episode they're kind of talking in these stories and just they're speaking very elaborately to each other, and they're almost enjoying the word games. Again, he tells that story about, you know, she tells the story about the tree, you know. They are very much talking about their situation while talking about other things, which I wonder if that's intended to be an aspect of Bajoran culture that is being subtly done. Like, they just happen to like stories and metaphors. But
I think that's I don't know that that's something that's ever explicitly developed in the series, but I think that that's kind of an interesting read on their culture.
Yeah, because, I mean, again, they both seem to like, you know, she seems to, after a while, enjoy his bullshit, and, you know, she can give it as good as he does. And, you know, that's a degree of, again, they have a very bantery relationship in a lot of ways, which demonstrates their, you know, respect and chemistry with each other. But yeah, if he needs to be likable because the decision has to be a very difficult one. If he was an asshole, and, you know, then she wouldn't have any problems just, you know, essentially arresting him and, you know, beaming him up whether he cared or not, you know?
This is making me realize that one of the things about Bajoran culture is that, you know, as we know from Emissary, the pilot, the Bajoran planet is on the brink of civil war, and it has serious problems, serious fractures in its society. And the only thing keeping it together is the Bajoran religion, the prophets. And if there's one thing, you know, leaving aside, you know, the political, cultural, and social context of religion, you know, I don't want to talk about Earth religion, but I just mean in a certain sense, you know, the thing that religion does really well, or one of the things that it does really well, is myth building and storytelling.
Yeah.
And so if you have a people who have really nothing in common besides their religion, I think that is going to manifest itself into this kind of narrative storyteller culture, perhaps.
So, yeah, I mean, to that, a degree, their religion kind of, is their culture. I mean, the fact that, you know,
well, that even ties back to the episode from last week's, you know, the storyteller. You know, I mean, that's kind of another aspect of Bajoran culture that fits in with that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, you know, is very prominent on every Bajoran is the earring, and it's, you know, I guess that's another. It's a piece of costume design that they only every so often mention, but I think it's very, given that it seems to have some kind of religious significance to it, it's a very prominent reminder of how united by religion this culture is. Yeah, again, and I think it's making it clear that, at least from what we've seen, you know, I think Bajoran religion is a good, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think it seems to be portrayed as having the problematic elements. Those seem to be foisted on the state and the, you know, almost tribal, I guess, elements is what it seems to be suggesting.
So, you don't think that there are Vedics in, you know, Bajoran Ireland that are,
yeah,
molesting little boys? not to make too fine a point on it and make too crude of an analogy, but
no,
yeah,
like,
I don't think
that anybody, you know, feels, you know, this doesn't seem to be a religion that's designed to be oppressive. It's more designed to, in a spiritual searching kind of a way, you know. Again, they, given that their religion seems to be based on these artifacts that, you know, they got from elsewhere, I mean, it almost seems to, as I said, there is an understanding of the scientific behind it, but taking these spiritual insights out of it, from what we've seen, that seems to be where a lot of their religion comes from.
Well, let me ask you this, because the only Bajoran character that we really had much time with before DS9 was Ro Laren, and as we know, Ro was not religious, and Ro refused to wear the earring. And if you're talking about the earring perhaps serving as a very visual signifier that this person is with you in a real sense, you know, this is a person that understands the power of the Bajoran religion in holding the planet together. And you have this character who doesn't wear the earring and doesn't believe in the Bajoran religion. You know, does that indicate perhaps that? Because I don't think that Mullabok wears an earring, and so I think that that's kind of interesting. But at the same time, he has a Bajoran religious symbol as a window. You know, what that kind of thing, like, what does that mean exactly? I don't know what it means, but I think it's kind of interesting.
I mean, to me, Ro almost comes off as the kind of person who, again, grew up Catholic, but, like, wears a cross necklace all the time and just, like, has that just as such a part of her almost. I mean, keep in mind, her arc, whether that was what was intended or not, because wasn't she intended to be the Kira character or something?
Well, I mean, they wanted her to join the cast of DS9, and Michelle Forbes didn't want to.
But, you know, at the end, she does fold back into, you know, Bajoran, you know, freedom fighting. And I don't know, I guess her feeling apart from that seems in touch with her general ambivalence kind of towards everything. You know, Ro doesn't really know what she wants until that moment. And I don't know, I think it does symbolize, I think the fact that she does wear it shows that she does have a stronger tie to it than perhaps she is willing to admit.
Yeah, that could be. And I also think that one of the things that this makes me think of is the Bajoran religion may be very strong on the on Bajor, on the homeworld. But as we know, Ro Laren did not grow up on Bajor. She grew up on a separate planet in a Cardassian camp. We know that Mullabak escaped Bajor and lived on one of their moons. So there could be the implication there, maybe there's some sort of subtext there that Bajorans who were forcibly removed from Bajor or left Bajor of their own volition, or really not. I mean, I don't want to say that Mullabak left Bajor of his own volition. He was forced out by the Cardassians, even if it was kind of his choice to leave. It kind of wasn't. And you know what I mean? Like, it's a very gray area. That it could just be that people that leave Bajor don't. The religion doesn't serve as much of a purpose because there are other things that are keeping them together. And frankly, you know, it sounds like there weren't more than a handful of people living on that moon anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I got the sense it, you know, his homestead was him and those two people, but maybe it was the kind of place where the neighbors were really far apart from each other. Even everyone,
I think that the Bajoran official said that there were like 50 people there.
Yeah. So yeah,
on the whole moon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you get the sense there, and they're probably just as, you know, antisocial as he is. Maybe not quite as stubborn, or maybe they frankly didn't get someone as sympathetic as Kira.
Well, yeah, and I think it's also really interesting and very indicative that the two people that he chooses to live with can't speak. I mean, you know, there's a lot of resonances there that I think are kind of, you know, nicely tied together. I don't think that they were intentional, but I think it all works together.
Yeah,
really,
you know,
well.
I don't think the episode quite says he's portrayed as a very flawed character. You know, a bit. You know, he's very stubborn. He's not listening to reason. I think the episode thinks that he's wrong. The episode doesn't think, you know, kind of agrees that, yes, this was necessary at the time. And this, you know, and it is very, you know, it was good that he was able to make a life for himself. That was a defiance. That was, you know, telling the Cardassians that, no, this isn't. You know, you can't take away my freedom. I'm still going to make a farm and I'm going to make my life, you know, and, you know, you can't kill me that way. But again, his war is over, too. You know, just as Kira needs to stop fighting and realize that she's back with, you know, that she's the boss, you know, he has to realize they're not fighting anymore.
Yeah, well, I think
or they're
that
fighting
that's
a
really...
different they're fighting something different now. Again, they are fighting now to restore Bajor, and he has.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, by him staying on this moon, he's almost shirking that responsibility, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, one of the interesting things here that just made me realize is that there's a real parallel between, you know, Kira and Mullabok's story here, because, of course, Mullabok doesn't want to change and neither does Kira. And at the end of the episode, Kira has changed, I think, in a fundamental way. In that she realizes that she has taken an oath, she has a duty to do what her superior officers want her to do and what her government wants her to do, even if she doesn't personally agree with it. Because, of course, she was someone who I think that her personal beliefs and her professional beliefs, if you want to call them that, when she was a freedom fighter or a terrorist, depending on your point of view, were very closely aligned. And so what you have is her changing into something else and Mullabok refusing to change into something else. And at the end of the episode, Kira has basically forced Mullabok not to change, but to leave. And I think that I don't think that there's a way for Mullabok really to go back from that.
I mean, in a way, put it this way, Kira really didn't have to change until the wormhole opened. And then suddenly the situation became very different in a way. She has to grow up because outside circumstances demand it at this point. You know, she can't stay the way she was. The world has very legitimately changed, and her burning down his house at the end is that equivalent, you know? You know, the only an, she obviously she has such an affinity for him because she sees herself in him, and that's, I guess, why she realizes he's never going to leave until he has nothing to stay. You know, he has to be forced out, because she can probably imagine how tough he was getting to this moon in the first place. They probably had to destroy his her house on Bajor, you know?
Well, yeah, because I think that, the end of the episode when she, I mean, she burns down his house, which is frankly, I mean, that's just horrible. But
and then it just, like, the episode just kind of, like, ends right after that. Like, I love just how, in a way, abruptly it ended at that point.
Yeah, but I think that, it's a really good ending, and it's a really striking ending, and I think it's something that, Deep Space Nine can do that, TNG perhaps can't do. But that's you know, Kira burning down his house is Kira realizing that she needs to get him out of here in any means possible. And if we talk about TNG being a show that really doesn't believe that the means justify the ends, I think that Deep Space Nine might be setting him, might be setting itself up in direct contradiction to that. It might be saying the ends do justify the means. Like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's not like his house was going to be destroyed by this. I think they say it was just going to be like CO2 emission type things. But in a way, that's kind of just, this is what's going to happen if you stay here. You know, this is this life is being destroyed and you need to see it. You know, that's kind of really her. He's in, I mean, I think at that point he's been in denial this entire time. You know, he is.
Sure.
You know, he's building a kiln that we know this entire time he's not going to be ever going to be able to use. What, you know, while through the episode it's not clear whether he's going to end up dying beforehand or whether they're going to get him off and how they're going to get him off, but it's very clear he's not going to be using that kiln. And
right,
you know, yeah, she has to force his hand at that point because that's what's going to happen. He can't, you know. I thought it was very interesting how he keeps saying, like, oh, if I leave this place, I'll die, which we've seen last week even, and we've seen a lot of episodes in this franchise where that happens to someone literally, like they have a physical connection with the land, a nano machines or whatever that are keeping them alive. But,
oh, yeah,
you know, I thought that was a funny line because in this case, it is almost, it is bullshit. We saw last week a group of people who quite literally will die if they don't leave the land that they're on. He's just going to be really sad. You know,
well, I agree with you and I disagree with you because I think that we all know stories of married couples who.
Oh, yes.
One of them dies and the other one is in perfect health, or, well, I mean, is in perfect health as old people can
be.
And dies, you know, 9 months or a year later. You know, you hear stories about people going into nursing homes and just, you know, dying. I mean, they're leaving their home of 40 years and they just die. I think that, you know, to a certain degree, Mullabok is being melodramatic and saying that. But to a certain degree, I think that it's very possible that he could die.
No,
you know, I think it is possible to die of a broken heart.
I agree with that. I think the episode is also saying that he doesn't have the luxury of dying of a broken heart, though. You know, again, there is
I don't know that he, I mean, I think that whether or not, I think this, the episode is really coming down on the side of whether or not Mullabok dies of a broken heart, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
which is kind of dark, frankly.
Of course.
Let's talk about Nog and Jake, though.
I like Nog and Jake.
They're, what are you thinking of?
I mean, this was a nice, very light B plot. I think it's nice that just as Jake taught Nog how to read, Nog is teaching Jake how to greed. And, he's, you know, I like that they kind of switch, you know, halfway through once they get the land, like, oh my God, they're getting the land. Oh my God, land is money. Oh my God. Oh, that's. That didn't click till just now.
What are you talking about?
The A plot of the episode, the Kira plot, is about someone holding value to his land.
Sure.
And the Nog and Jake plot, the punchline of it is land, which ends up having a very high degree of value, even though they think it might be worthless.
Okay. That might be a little bit of a stretch, but I'll give it to you.
And, it's interesting how they, I mean, it may not be just any more simple than both subplots deal with land in a different way, but, you know, it's a nice resonance. But again, anyway, I liked halfway through Nog's willing to give up and Jake's like, no, we're close, you know, and, you know, I was expecting to be annoyed by the concept of a Nog and Jake subplot because I have been annoyed by Nog and Jake subplots, but I'm starting to warm up to them.
Yeah, they're not bad characters, and I think that the nice thing about Deep Space Nine is that they're coming into the show, you know, being teenagers, and they leave the show being young adults, and so you do get to see them grow and change. What I like about this subplot, I think, is that it's a good example of Deep Space Nine doing a bit of comedy and doing it well, and giving the actors, I mean, O'Brien and Odo and Quark, and, you know, giving them a different opportunity to do something a little bit different and just kind of like drop in and do a cameo in their own show and then leave. I like the fact that Deep Space Nine is making the station kind of feel like there's stuff going on the edges that we don't really know about. And the other part, of course, is that I think that you know, the Kira and Mullabok story is so dark and kind of so oppressive, frankly, that while I think that this could be construed as very tonally off, this kind of light comedy, haha, Nog and Jake are teenagers trying to make a little bit of money. I think it works because it's not entirely goofy, and it adds a nice level of lightness to the episode that I think the episode needs.
Comic relief is a term, you know, reason. And that's, you know, it's, I don't want to say subtle, but it's not like wacky and goofy and all over the place. No, it's just this chain of deals doesn't go indefinitely. It goes just as long as it needs to.
Because the episode fundamentally takes it seriously.
Yeah.
While it is a little bit funny because, you know, teenagers trying to make money is funny and wheeling and dealing and pretending to be adults is funny. At the end of the day, and this is what I like about Deep Space Nine so far, and frankly, this is what I like about The Next Generation as well, is that the show is fundamentally taking these characters seriously.
Well,
and
you
so
know,
you know,
yeah, they show number one. Underlying all of this is the fact that we've been told time and time, well, humans and Ferengi can't really get along. And here is, you know, humans and Ferengi going, you know, kind of applying their specific culture's talents and instincts, you know, to the tune of five bars of gold pressed latinum, you know.
Sure.
And it's interesting. When you say about they're kind of dropping as cameos, I think it's kind of funny to see we don't really see O'Brien and Odo. They interact differently with these two, obviously, than they do with other characters. And they're old enough that they can have, you know, not quite an equal interaction, but, you know, a fairly sophisticated one with adults.
Yeah.
But they're young enough that they don't quite take them seriously enough, you know?
Yeah, and I think that that's interesting because I think that gets to the heart of what's going on with Jake and Sisko, or well, Jake and his father, not, you know, because Jake is Sisko as well, Ben. Benjamin is having to start to take his son seriously as a young adult in a way that he has not been had to do before, and I think that that's kind of what the show is trying to push them to.
Yeah, well, And
the other thing is that, you know, you talking about how Ferengi and humans have never really been able to form a cultural bond or any sort of understanding is true. And like a lot of Deep Space Nine, the only thing I will say about that is stay tuned, because that is something that is developed specifically through the character of Nog, but I think also through the character of Rom and the character of Quark. I mean, you know, that's Deep Space Nine is the show that kind of redeems the Ferengi in a lot of ways and makes them very. It's consistent in its characterization of the Ferengi without making it impossible for other people to like or even understand them.
Okay, I mean, like I think it's interesting because a lot of this episode is about Quark learning to take Nog a little more seriously. Again, he has that, you know, one little moment when he's trying, you know, early on when he, you know, kind of cons him into giving him all of this sauce. And he's like, oh, you're a good boy, you know, Nog, whatever.
Yamek
you know.
Sauce.
Yeah. But at the end, you know, when Quark realizes that there has been action going on the station that he had no idea what, you know, was going on, which to him is, you know, Quark has a hand in everything, and to realize that it was his own nephew and his friend, like, and that they've brokered this, you know, that they've blundered into this perfect deal. I mean, you know, I'm thinking even back on the Negus at one point praises Quark for building next to the wormhole, even though he didn't know that that would happen. You know, I think it's interesting that Ferengi treat blunders as instinct, you know?
Yeah, like, yeah. And I think that Quark really is impressed by Nog.
Yeah,
frankly.
Because he's gotten to this point and he's gotten a very good deal that is going to get everybody profitable. I mean, that's I like that it and you know, it ended very good for them, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Just as a, yeah, again, it wasn't a huge thing. This may not be one of the classic DS9 subplots, but it was, again, for the episode, it was a very good contrast to the heaviness of what was going on, and I laughed a couple points.
Good. Well, let's move on to our next episode for this week, which is also a contrast from Progress, If Wishes Were Horses, which, that certainly is an episode of Deep Space Nine.
All right, so remember how we had that, what was the episode the other week that was a holdover from a TNG script that never got made?
The Storyteller?
Okay, yeah. Was this originally an animated series episode? Because this was...
No, it wasn't.
This was not. It wasn't as dire as it could have been. The guy who played Rumpelstiltskin, Michael Anderson, I like him a lot, and they could have picked someone horrible. He did the best you could do with that role.
Well, I'm rewatching The X-Files in preparation for the miniseries coming up in January, and I watched one of the first comedic episodes of the show, Humbug, and he's in that. And so I was kind of like, oh yeah, I like this guy. I want to propose a rule, Richard, for Trek About. Are you ready for this? I think that if we see an episode has five or more writers, we should just skip it.
Oh, I didn't know it had that many.
Yeah, I understand that will put Yesterday's Enterprise in that bucket as well, which I believe was written by the entire starting lineup of the Milwaukee Brewers. But anyway.
Okay. No wonder it turned into a baseball game halfway through. I didn't understand that when I saw it at the time. Like, they challenged the Romulans and they showed all nine innings. It was weird.
Tasha Yar is there and she's like, let's play ball. Yeah, If Wishes for Horses is not great, and it's not bad, it's just profoundly mediocre.
Well, I mean, so again, comparing this to earlier episodes, I'm thinking of Shore Leave, which was the same kind of episode. Stuff from people's imagination gets manifested into real life.
Sure.
Shore Leave is one of my favorite episodes of the original series because... It's, number one, a very different look for the series. That one, it was one of the episodes that filmed outside, and it's a very, you know, pretty episode. And everything just kind of goes a little batshit. You know, you have, you know, knights running around, and you have a samurai attacking, you know, Sulu, and you have, you know, the White Rabbit and Alice in Wonderland. Like, if you're going to have an episode that's showing things from people's imaginations... And you have, you know, Horny Dax, a baseball player, and Michael Anderson playing Rumpelstiltskin as your main lineup, and then a couple emus, and that's about it. Like, it was very tame, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it all feels very inert. Like, there doesn't...
Yeah!
It doesn't feel as crazy as it needs to.
And, yeah! And maybe, again, you have an entire station of different cultures of... different races of aliens, of different species, and that's it? It was underwhelming.
I guess my point is really, what is the point of this episode? I don't know why this was written. There's something to be said for an episode like Shore Leave, which is just an excuse to go outside and show some crazy things and have Kirk get into a fist fight. Great, fine, fantastic, love it. This episode, it's not interesting. There's nothing crazy going on aside from the one brief scene where it's snowing on the promenade and then it completely disappears. And there's an emu running around, which, fun fact.
That was the only part I liked.
That was the only time that an emu ever appeared on Star Trek.
Wow. You
know, okay. This is the trivia that we have.
What did Brandon Braga think of the emu?
I don't know.
I mean, I liked Odo. Where Odo and the emu had very good chemistry together. I really liked when he's shooing the emu away.
I think that Odo should have shapeshifted into a female emu or a male emu, depending, and you know, should have gotten away the emu way there that way. I want to see emu sex, basically, is what I'm saying.
You know, we can make this happen.
And the other fun thing about this episode, and as much as anything is fun about it, is that originally Rumpelstiltskin was supposed to be a leprechaun, and Cole Meany got extremely angry about it and basically said, people in Ireland find leprechauns very, very offensive. I will not do this. And they had to figure out a way to make it work, and so they turned it into Rumpelstiltskin.
Did they really find leprechauns offensive?
I guess. I don't know. I mean, I would not presume to disagree with Cole Meany about that, and he is Irish, so. But it's just, you know, the whole episode just feels very inert, and it doesn't feel like anything really is happening, and everyone is talking about how crazy this is and how dangerous it is, and, you know, you've got a baseball player wandering around, you've got a leprechaun who doesn't seem to, or not a leprechaun, you've got Rumpelstiltskin who doesn't seem to be really doing anything at all, and then you've got this huge, you know, space anomaly technobabble thing. And the whole thing is just kind of like, why is any of this happening?
Why didn't we have a scene where Rumpelstiltskin is bargaining with Rom to get to for Nog, and like Quark yells at him? Like, why don't we have these kind of things happening? Why is it, again, it should have been as wacky as it could have been, but they didn't. It seemed like this seemed like an episode of somebody who they wanted to make a comedy episode, but they were worried that a comedy episode would cause too much chaos and they wouldn't be able to manage it. And so it feels too reined in.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I keep coming back to. Yeah. It felt boring.
I think that that's a good approach to it. And I also think that that part of that might just be budgetary. I mean, I don't know what kind of budgetary restrictions the show was under at this point. And I think that doing that kind of episode and doing that kind of craziness would be expensive, you know. But what happens is, if you can't afford to do the episode well, then don't do the episode. I mean, I can't imagine that. I mean, this is a shorter season. I mean, well, it's funny that it's a shorter season and it's still 19 episodes. But you know, in terms of a regular Star Trek season of 26 episodes, this is still well under that. And you're telling me that they didn't have other scripts that they could do better than this? I mean, the whole thing is just, you know, there's nothing to get out of this episode.
Okay, so at the end, I feel like I want to talk about the ending already. Like, because it's the only part that had like anything to it, I guess. But so at the end, they're talking and they're saying, you know, oh, well, we're aliens and we're just trying to see who you are. And woo, we're mysterious, you know.
So yeah, which one, is just, yeah.
Number one, does that the show is able to introduce
do
a
they
threat
come back?
Like that?
No.
Yeah. See, because here I am thinking, all right, well, that's fine. You know, they're shitty, but, you know, something, they're setting up some kind of a plot thread, and then unfortunately, we're going to get the sequel to this episode, but someone's going to reveal themselves and say, we're from the Gamma Quadrant and we've been watching you, you know, which is
no, that doesn't happen. And I'm glad it doesn't happen, because I don't think that that would have been good in any way, shape or form.
No,
you know, and
I know,
this is,
but well, so it's even more pointless.
Oh, no, it totally is pointless. And I think that one of the things about this, of course, is that we were talking about the Gamma Quadrant aliens just being assholes who don't want to explain themselves whatsoever. And here's just another in a long line of asshole aliens from the Gamma Quadrant who
playing
cause
to
trouble.
Some kind of rules that we don't know.
And then Sisko even flat out asks them, like, what they're doing. And he's like, maybe we'll tell you later. And it's like, what? Like, that just, to me, is a total cop-out on the episode's part.
I mean, here, you know, my other question watching that scene, and I admit I was not paying too close attention at that point because I was too busy, you know, trying to
flagellating yourself.
Let's not talk about that in front of the audience. But, you know, and they say something like, we wanted to learn what imagination was, or we didn't know what imagination, or you're the only species to have imagination, or something like that. Uh-huh. And but how did they do it if they didn't know what imagination was? How did they make these imagination rays? Like, I don't even know. It was just
I don't know.
I'm trying to think if I want to talk about the Dax and Bashir subplot, and I don't know if I do or not.
Oh, no, I want to talk about it. I think that, that this episode has finally, I mean, hopefully, maybe, I don't know. But I think that this episode has maybe finally put a cap on that. And at the very beginning of the episode, Bashir is still aggressively hitting on Dax and, you know, basically all that friend zone bullshit, which is total, you know, BS. And, you know, because, of course, women can sleep whoever they want.
Yeah.
You know, the friend zone is kind of a bullshit concept. And, you know, Bashir is complaining about it. And he's like, I want you to touch my penis, Dax. Will you please touch my, you know, and the whole thing is just aggressively unpleasant. And Bashir is aggressively unpleasant in this episode.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we realize that his secret desire is to have a Dax who just wants to be all over him all the time, which, OK.
Well, you know, it's his nighttime fantasy and fine. But, you know, and I mean, I like Dax's initial reaction, you know, to that when she basically says, like, look, that's about, you know, she's not horrified by it. You know, she seems to take it in stride. She, as she explained, she was a man in a previous incarnation, and she knows what nighttime thoughts are, and she knows that, you know, he's probably more embarrassed about it than she ever could be, in a way.
Well, sure. I think that it's a good episode for Dax because Dax, of course, is in some sense 300 years old. And so Dax has kind of seen everything. And Dax has a lot of perspective. I think that's right.
You know, she has issues with the particular portrayal of it. And I think it's I like how, you know, when she and the other she are arguing with it. Yeah, but
anyway. But, you know, aside from that, I do think that the episode perhaps has kind of, I think maybe realize that they've taken the Bashir stalking Dax thing about as far as it can go, and this is kind of the end of it. I hope. I don't know.
Well, but, you know, yeah, I mean, she's on no uncertain terms says, you know, look, I just see us as, you know, I don't have those feelings for you. And he's fine, you know, I think he's finally giving up on that. And at this point, he's probably too embarrassed to think about her in that way anymore, you know?
Oh,
every time he, you know, sits down at night and masturbate to thoughts of Terry Farrell, he's remembering the time. He's remembering the fact that everybody knows that he does that, and he's not gonna, you know, he's gonna feel a bit awkward about that.
Yeah, I think so. But I think that's really the problem with the episode, though, is that Bashir is really the only character who has a fantasy or an imagination come to life that is at all related to who they are as a character, really.
Or that gives them any growth or change. I mean, yeah.
I mean, you know, Buck Bakai and Cisco and Jake and baseball is really important to them, and that's fine. I mean, that's, you know, that's,
but we knew that it's a reiteration of the theme, but it doesn't really give us any new insight. We know Cisco loves his son, and baseball is how they bonded.
Right. It doesn't give us any new information.
We knew that in the pilot.
Quark's, you know, women don't give us any new information because we knew the Quark was a creep. You know, and so there's these things where you're just kind of like, this is very obvious. This is not, you know, I don't watch this episode. I don't watch this show to see obvious things. I watch this show to be challenged. I watch the show to be entertained. And this episode is neither. It's just there.
Yeah, it is. You know,
I did like that Kira spouts technobabble and then literally says, what the hell does that mean? I think that was a nice moment for her character. I appreciated that.
You know, something I forgot to, this is actually making me think of something from the first episode about Dax, you know, Dax and Bashir's conversation. But the first episode opened with Kira and Dax talking about this guy that Dax is, you know, may or may not be interested in. And I don't know, it was interesting because I actually liked that moment because, you know, there's the usual Bechdel test. You know, you have two women characters, all they are going to be talking about is a man. You know, that's the cliched But in this case, number one, it is nice to see that these two characters are starting, you know, do have a friendship with each other. I like seeing the development of relationships on the show. But it has an interesting twist to it because, in a way, Dax and Sisko had that kind of conversation, but about women in her previous incarnation. And this is, I don't know, not necessarily saying that Kira is the new Sisko, but it's interesting to see them kind of bonding together in that way. I don't know, it's seeming like another incarnation of that kind of a friendship.
Well, yeah, I think so. And I think that the one thing that is consistent about Dax in both of these episodes is that she is very interested in being friends with almost everybody in the command staff. I mean, you know, I think that she and Sisko are friends, she and Bashir are perhaps becoming friends, she and Kira are becoming friends. And I don't know that necessarily works. I don't think that Dax is a character that they've really figured out yet. But I think that maybe they're starting to, and I think maybe this is how they're doing that. Maybe they're having Dax tell them who she is by having her become friends and having conversations with with other characters. And I'm fine with that. I think if that's how they're going to figure that character out, then that's great.
Yeah. Well, there we go.
But yeah, on the whole, I don't think that there's much else to say about If Wishes Were Horses. I think it's just, it's kind of tedious. It's kind of boring. There's really nothing there. And at the end of the day, it's a complete Deus Ex Machina ending, which doesn't really go anywhere. And we have aliens that refuse to explain themselves because of the plot. And it's just very unsatisfying.
If 10 years from now I rewatch the series, I will skip this episode. Like that I'm just going to make. That is my promise to you.
But how can you, though? Because Molly is so adorable.
I mean, yeah, but at what cost?
That's true. Also, fun fact, the actress who played Molly was very terrified of Rumpelstiltskin and did not want to be in the same room with him.
Yeah, I can believe that. Yeah, that's true. They're never in the shot together. And he isn't even, like, played creepy, you know? I think, you know...
Well, that's really the thing. I mean, the whole thing is just so tame. Like,
he's not... Yeah. He's not played as terrifying. He's not played as funny. Like, it's neither. It is just kind of there, you know? If he were this stalking presence, like, oh my god, Rumpelstiltskin, you know, all right, but...
And that's really weird, because there seems to be a level of engagement with these imagination things that is very strange, because I was about to say, well, of course, Rumpelstiltskin is a figment of O'Brien's imagination because he was reading the story to Molly, and maybe he just doesn't know that much about Rumpelstiltskin. So Rumpelstiltskin is kind of a flat character because of, you know, O'Brien's lack of knowledge about him. But then Buck Bokai seems to be like the real guy. And so the whole thing is just very strange, because Buck Bokai is saying things that are kind of in his head. And it's not like Sisko would know that. So the whole thing is very weird. And it's just, it's very uneven, and I want to say, and not fully thought out.
Rumpelstiltskin sort of is trying to, he talks a little bit. So when he says, like, oh, you're afraid of me, they're trying to connect it to O'Brien's fears of losing his daughter, you know, which is a normal parental fear. And that would have been a very interesting thing for O'Brien, you know, to go through, and to have that be a very strong, you know, have this character be a very strong physical presence of that fear. But it's just kind of there. Again, they don't really do anything with any of it. Maybe that's because the actress playing Molly again was too scared to be in the scene with him, and so, you know, they couldn't have any interactions where he's, you know, afraid that, oh my god, he's grabbing, you know, I don't know, but
I don't know. I really have no idea. And I think that what that tells me is that this episode could have gone in about four different directions, all of them interesting, and it chose to just stay on the straight path of mediocrity. I think the show has already shown us they can do better than this. And
yeah,
it's, you know, it's not terrible. Like, it's certainly not embarrassing, I guess.
It's not the alternative factor.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I guess it's kind of a good thing that a bad episode of the show is just kind of mediocre and not.
It's not like the episode where the one ambassador ate the other. Yeah.
Right. So maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
It's not that good.
Well, no, it's not that good. Well, if you would like to share your thoughts on either one of the episodes, please do so on the post for this podcast at truckaboutshow.com. Please follow us on Twitter for all of our Twitter updates at twitter.com/truckaboutshow. like us on Facebook at facebook.com/truckaboutshow, where you can also leave comments about the episodes if you so desire to.
And why wouldn't always, you?
And why wouldn't you? Because Facebook is great. And as always, leave us a positive iTunes review. It is the best way to bump us up in the rankings, get new listeners to the show, and all of that good stuff. And if you leave us a review, we'll read your name on the show. How about that? Next week, we are talking about The Forsaken and Dramatis Personae.
Wow.
That was very unexcited.
Hey, after this week, can you blame me?
Well, I will just say that one of the episodes next week is the return of an old friend from TNG.
Oh, it's Q again, isn't it?
It's not Q. I'm serious. Q never appears in DS9.
I really don't. I've been burned before. Fool
right,
me once.
Look, I'm
shame
trying
on you.
I'm
fool
trying
me once.
To help
shame
you.
On Q.
I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to dissuade you from the fear and angst and anxiety about just when is Q going to appear again. He doesn't. He doesn't appear again in Deep Space Nine. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
You can let that one go. But someone else from TNG does. So we'll find out who that is next week.